I've got a suggestion for your group name, Scott, since I know where you're from. Why don't you just call yourselves Identity Crisis? And maybe that'd be a good group name for you. But if I'd known if they was going to be there, I'd be here. I would have called in sick tonight and just let y'all listen to him, to them. Some of you probably noticed that Billy's name was on the sign this week to be preaching tonight, and I intentionally left that up there hoping that more people would come because I figured you'd want to hear him more than you want to hear me. So those of you who showed up expecting Billy, you fuss at him when he gets back, okay? Not me. Billy's been down in South Georgia since about Wednesday, I think, helping with some of the disaster relief cleanup. The disaster relief training we went to last week, they said that Georgia is going to partner with South Carolina Baptist, and once they finish in South Georgia, we're going to focus on a county, I think it's Clay County, just south of Jacksonville. It's going to be where Georgia Baptist and South Carolina Baptist focus, and it's probably going to be, well, who knows how long the rebuild will be. This will probably be an ongoing thing for 2 or 3 years. But anyway, that's where Billy has been, and so he asked if I would fill in tonight, and I told him I'd be glad to. Y'all are going to get tired of me because I'll be preaching again Wednesday night and then again next Sunday morning, and it'll probably be so bad by then I'm leaving town after that. I'm going to be gone on the 8th, so if y'all want to throw tomatoes or something, come and throw it at whoever's on up here on the 8th, okay? How many of you like roller coasters? Like to ride roller coasters? Or do we have a bunch of chickens in here, I guess? I remember several years ago when I was in college, a friend of mine and I was going to school in North Carolina at the time. We went down to Disney World. My dad was able to get us some free passes into Disney World, so we took advantage of that, and we went for a couple of days. And the great thing about it was is we went right after college got out, you know, and so the primary schools, high schools, that kind of thing, public schools were still in session. This has been 30 years ago now. And so there was hardly anybody there. I mean, you can't go to Disney World now and there not be a huge crowd. But we went to Disney World and we were there on a weekday. It was like a Tuesday and Wednesday or something like that. And we were able to ride Space Mountain, the roller coaster that's there, just one time after another. We'd ride it, and we'd get off, and we'd go right back around. There was no line at all. We'd get back on probably about the next train that went or the one after that, you know. And it was great. We loved that. But, you know, I haven't always been a roller coaster person. I'm kind of outgrowing that a little bit, I think. My kids, our daughters fuss at us because they think they're the only people in the world that have never been to Disney World. By the way, how many of you in here have never been to Disney World? Oh, see, we got proof here. Okay, thank you. Y'all are going to be support for us when we tell our girls they're not the only ones that haven't been to Disney World. But anyway, some people like roller coasters and some don't. But do you ever feel like life is a roller coaster? You do, don't you? Because there are certainly ups and downs, there are highs and lows, there are twists and turns that come at you in life, and unlike a roller coaster, except for Space Mountain where you're riding in the dark, most of them you can see what's coming. You can see the hill, or you can see the curve, or the twist, or the loop. But in life, the ups and downs, you don't know when those are coming. You don't know when you're going to be on that mountaintop, and you don't know when life's going to throw you that curve, and you're going to wind up in the valley. And unfortunately, a lot of people, even a lot of Christians, are slaves of their circumstances. And what I mean by that is that they feel about themselves, or they feel about life according to whatever their circumstances are. In other words, if their circumstances are good, they're good. You know, if their circumstances are up and everything's going good, they feel good about themselves, they feel good about life, they feel good about God, you know, it's just everything's good. But if their circumstances are bad, then they may feel like nobody loves them, or God doesn't care about them, or God's forgotten where they are, and their emotions are down. It's kind of like some college football fans, and I'm not picking on Alabama fans here, okay? But I knew this guy years ago as a young adult. He was an Alabama fan, and if Alabama won, I mean, it was like he won. You would have thought he scored the winning touchdown. He was just on top of the world. But if Alabama lost, he took it personally. And if you said anything to him about the game, it was like it was a personal offense to him. And there are fans like that of every school. I just happened to know one that was an Alabama fan. You know, but according to whatever their team has done, they're up or they're down. And a lot of people are like that in life. And I don't think we want to be that way. I think most people want to be able to say, you know, I don't want to be a slave to my circumstances. I don't want to just be up just because life is going good and down just because life is going bad. I think one of the keys to making it through life is somehow finding an ability to get to some sort of equilibrium so that there is some steadiness and there's some evenness to our life. And as Christians, certainly, we have to learn to be able to handle the ups in a good way, but also we have to be able to learn to handle the difficult times in a good way. Both of them can kind of cause you to lose your faith, you know, because when things are going good, you tend to, if you're not careful, you can kind of walk off and leave your faith because all of a sudden you think that it's all about you. And when things are going bad, you can tend to lose your faith or abandon your faith or think that your faith isn't working or isn't paying off. But somehow we've got to get to that point where we're steady and we get off of that roller coaster. And tonight, I want us to look for an answer in that or see an example of that in the person of Joseph. So if you want to open your Bible, just go ahead and open it to Genesis chapter 40. And I'm not going to read all of this, okay? There are parts of Genesis chapter 39, 40, and 41 that we're going to read. But I think Joseph is a great biblical example of a man who was steady. He had a very even keel. He was the same regardless of his situation. And it seemed like when he was up, he never got too high. And when things were going bad in his life, he never got too low. But he was able just to be steady and be even keeled and just sort of keep it all together. And so I want us just to think about his story this evening and think about why was he able to do that? Because I think he is a great example of that. So we're just going to talk through the story of Joseph a little bit tonight and read a few verses, and I think we'll discover why, what the secret was to his ability to not be a slave to his circumstances and sort of get off that emotional roller coaster, that up and down, not being able to handle the twists and turns of life that came his way. But you know the story of Joseph. Joseph was one of the sons of Jacob. We know that Joseph wasn't just one of the sons of Jacob, but he was the favorite son of Jacob. Remember, Jacob had 12 sons. So there's this big, huge family, and there's some dysfunction in that family like there was in every biblical family and like there is in every family, period. And Joseph was the favored son. How do we know that? Well, the Bible tells us very clearly. And then also remember, what did Jacob do? What did he give to Joseph that showed him, but not only Joseph, but his brothers also, that Joseph was the favorite of his father? His father gave him a coat of, we call, many colors. So Jacob gives Joseph this robe that is made of this fine linen. It's very colorful. And his brothers look at him and go, yeah, he's daddy's favorite. And they begin to be jealous of Joseph, and they don't really like him because they know that he's daddy's boy. And then remember, Joseph had the dreams. You remember the dreams that he had? And as a young teenager would do, you know, he gets up and he tells his brother this dream, and you know, he's telling him this dream, and they understand very quickly that he's saying that, hey, this dream seems to be saying you guys are eventually going to bow down to me. That wouldn't have played well with my brothers. You know, if I'd have told them, hey, I had this dream, and somewhere out there in the future, y'all are going to, like, serve me and everything, you know. Y'all are going to be beneath me. They probably thought that I felt that way anyway. But you can imagine how that went over. They weren't very pleased with that. And then a few days later, we're told that he had another dream. And this time, the brothers were included in it, but it also said that the sun and the moon bowed down to Joseph. And who were they? That was their parents. And so now they're going, boy, you're really full of yourself, aren't you? Now you're saying not only us, not only all of your brothers are going to bow down to you, but mom and dad are too? Who do you think you are? And you know, you go in and read the story, and Joseph's brothers are out tending their sheep, and Jacob comes to him one day and says, hey, Joseph, I want you to go check on your brothers. Well, they're out there tending the sheep, and they're doing like what most brothers would, who know that there's daddy's favorite in the family, they're muttering and griping and complaining about Joseph. And they've about had enough of Joseph and his, you know, thinking too highly of himself and being daddy's favorite and that kind of thing. And so they're talking about, they just don't like Joseph. And then they see him coming in the distance. And you remember what the discussion turned to. They said, yeah, there comes Joseph. Hey, why don't we get rid of him? Now, can you imagine that? God, here comes our brother. I tell you what, when he gets here, let's kill him. Now, that's pretty drastic, isn't it? You know, I mean, I've known brothers that fight. Me and my brothers fought, but I don't think they ever really plotted to kill me or anything like that. You know, at least I hope they didn't anyway. Scott, your brother never plotted to kill you, did he? I mean, he was here tonight, so. Okay, good. Yeah. Your dad could break you up, I'm sure. So they plot to kill him. What we'll do is we'll kill him, and we'll take his robe because it'll be bloody, and we'll tell Dad that a wild animal attacked him. And can you imagine how that would have gone over? It'd be like, what, did y'all just sit there and let the animal? Y'all didn't even bring him back to bury him? You just left him out there? And so they have this plot, but one of them, Reuben, says, you know, he's thinking, he's kind of playing along, but he's also thinking, I don't know, man, this doesn't sound like a good idea to me, you know. He says, I'll tell you what, instead of killing him, there's a well over here, there's an old abandoned dry well over here. Let's just throw him down in that hole and we'll just leave him. Because Reuben was planning on, this is a detail that we miss a lot of times, Reuben was planning on coming back and rescuing him and taking him home. And so they go, oh, okay, all right, we'll do that. And so when Joseph gets there, his brothers attack him, I assume, and they throw him in this pit. And then they're kind of going, well, all right, so what do we do now? And their plan then is to kill a sheep or a goat and dip the robe in the blood and take it home and say, Dad, man, we hate to tell you this, but when Joseph showed up out there, we were just, you know, having family time and an animal attacked him and killed him, and this is all that's left. But along about that time, they see some people coming along. They say, you know, why should we just leave him here? Let's try to turn this to our advantage. And their plan is to sell him into slavery. You know this story, right? So Joseph, you see, he's on this roller coaster. He's the favored son. He has this dream that everybody seems to acknowledge, okay, there's something to this, and Joseph is saying that somehow he's going to be lifted up and honored in a way that his family's going to come and sort of bow down before him. And so he's kind of riding high there, and he's got the favored status in the family. But then his brothers hate him so much that they throw him in a pit, and they're going to just leave him for dead. And then they come up with a plan that says, well, let's make some money off of this. And so there he is in the pit. Well, you know what happens. He gets sold into slavery, and they take him down to Egypt, and he's put on the block in Egypt. And who buys him? Potiphar. And Potiphar is an official with Pharaoh. He's some sort of bigwig. You know, he's some sort of important guy. And so Joseph is sold into slavery to Potiphar. And Joseph serves faithfully in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar is watching this young Hebrew boy named Joseph. And he says, you know, he's kind of got the touch. He's sort of got that it factor. Everything he does just goes well. I mean, it just, everything he does, everything he touches works out well. He's a great organizer. He's a great leader. He knows how to get things done. Tell you what, I'm going to take this Hebrew boy, this Joseph, and I'm going to put him in charge of all of my stuff. I'm going to make him like my vice president of my corporation. I'm going to put him in charge of everything. And so Joseph comes out of the pit of slavery, and all of a sudden now he is the right-hand man of this extremely wealthy and powerful man named Potiphar. And so he's back on top. His circumstances are good. He's probably feeling pretty good about himself, and he's probably feeling pretty good about life. Certainly a lot better than he was in that pit that his brothers were going to leave him in, right? And so now he's back on top, and you see this up and down, this up and down, this twist and turn throughout his life. And so things are going good for old Joseph. But then what happens one day? Potiphar's gone. He's out at work. Joseph's there in the house, and Potiphar's wife is there too, right? And Potiphar's wife, she says, wow, this little Joseph fella, you know, not only is he pretty good at handling my husband's business, but he's pretty good looking too. So she has a thing for Joseph, and she approaches him, and she propositions him. And you know the story. Joseph turns her down, says, I can't do something like that. I can't do that to Potiphar. He's entrusted everything in his entire home and all of his business. He's entrusted all of this to me. I could never do that to him. Well, of course, that offends Potiphar's wife. She doesn't take that too well. And she frames Joseph, if you will. She tells Potiphar that he made advances towards her. And so Potiphar, what does he do? Joseph's up on top, and he's about to come crashing down, right? Because Potiphar says, I entrusted everything in my world to you, and you do this to me. And what did Potiphar do? He had Joseph thrown in prison. And so Joseph is back in the pit. So we see this pattern going on up and down all throughout his life. And so he's been on top, he's been in the pit, he's been on top, he's been back in, and he's back in the pit, and now he's about to go and reach the ultimate heights. And that's where we're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 41, verses 39 through 44. Because remember, when Joseph was in prison, there were these two officials of Pharaoh's, the cupbearer, or sort of his butler, and the baker. Remember, they were in prison with Joseph. Joseph actually was a very good prisoner because the prison warden said, this Joseph guy is so good, I'm going to put him in charge of all the other prisoners. And so Joseph actually, even when he's in the pit, he's like the best one in there, okay? And one day, these two officials of Pharaoh come to him and say, hey, you know, Joseph, we've had these dreams, and can you help us? We heard that you've interpreted some dreams before. So he says, all right, tell me your dream. And they tell him the dream, and the butler tells him his dream, and basically Joseph says, well, what your dream means is that in 3 days, you're going to be restored to Pharaoh's service. You're going to get out of prison, and you're going to go back, and you're going to serve Pharaoh. And so the butler's like, wow, that sounds like a good thing. You know, I'm liking that message. And so can you imagine how the baker feels as he steps up? I mean, he's about to tell Joseph this dream, and he's like, wow, you know, the butler, the cupbearer, is going to be restored to service. No telling what good thing's going to happen to me. And so he tells Joseph the dream that he had, and Joseph says, well, what your dream means is that in the New King James, it uses the term going to lift your head up. Joseph says to the butler, he says, Pharaoh's going to lift your head up, and you're going to be restored to his service. And then he says to the baker, he says, I got news for you, baker. Pharaoh's going to lift your head up too, but it's not going to be the same result. Because what this dream is telling you is that in 3 days, Pharaoh's going to call you out of this prison, but he's going to put you to death. Can you imagine how bad the food must have been if Pharaoh was willing to kill his baker? I mean, you know, it must have really been awful. But the baker is going to be put to death. And that goes on, and Joseph tells the cupbearer, he says, just remember me and tell Pharaoh about me someday. And so a couple of years go by, and Pharaoh has this dream. Nobody can interpret it. And it clicks with this butler, this cupbearer. He says, oh yeah, I remember this guy in prison that interpreted my dream. And so he mentions him to Pharaoh. And of course, we know the story. Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dream, tells him what's going to happen about the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine, and sort of lays out the plan. And that's when when Joseph goes back to the palace. Look at Genesis chapter 41, verses 39 through 44. It says, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and as wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. So what we have here is we have this pattern of the pit and the palace in Joseph's life. And finally, Joseph makes it to the real palace. He becomes basically the prime minister of Egypt, the greatest power in the known world at that time. He's just a lowly Hebrew boy, like 10th born in his family, 11th born in his family, not even the oldest, not even the one that would receive all the greatest honors if he was back at home. But he's his father's favorite. He's just this lowly Hebrew boy. And through this series of ups and downs, Joseph ultimately winds up Pharaoh's second in command. Pharaoh puts him in charge of everything. He's the prime minister. Everybody in Egypt answers to Joseph. He's living a life of wealth and power and prestige. But the interesting thing about Joseph is that if you know his story and as you read his story, he never seems to get too high when he's up, and he never seems to get too low when things are down. It seems like whether he's in the pit or the palace, Joseph's just right here. He's just steady. He's just even keeled. He doesn't define himself by his circumstances and his situation. I think too many of us define ourselves by our circumstances and our situation. And unfortunately, sometimes as Christians, we define our faith by our circumstances and our situation. Or our faith rises and falls with our circumstances or our situation. But it doesn't appear to me that Joseph was that way. Normally, if you're going to be a person who's going to have a powerful position, a position of prestige, a position of influence. In our society, you go somewhere like Princeton or Harvard. Where did God send Joseph to prepare him for a place, a position of power and authority? He sent him to prison on two occasions. He sent him to the pit. And you know, some people, when they're in the pit, they're ready just to wash their hands of God and say, "God, you've abandoned me. God, where are you? God, I thought you loved me. God, didn't you see how faithful I've been? God, you know I've been trying to do my best for you. God, where are you?" Have you ever felt like God abandoned you? Probably most of us have. I mean, I think we as Christians need to be honest enough to say sometimes, you know, there was a time in my life where I just really felt like God abandoned me. And we know he didn't, okay? I'm just saying you might have felt that way, because that's just a human experience. And there are times when sometimes we get in that situation, we feel like, well, God, where are you? God, do you care about me? How was Joseph able to maintain just that even keel, that steadiness, through all of these ups and downs? I think this is the key. Joseph always had a very keen sense of his accountability to God. And he always had a very keen sense and awareness of God's presence and involvement in his life. And he understood that just because he was at what seemed to be the bottom, that didn't mean that God wasn't active in his life. That didn't mean that God didn't care about him. That didn't mean that God had forgotten about him. That didn't mean necessarily that God was punishing him. It just meant that he was in bad circumstances. But he always believed that God was with him. And then when he rose to power, when he rose to influence and position, he didn't beat his chest and say, "Oh, look at me, I've climbed the ladder. Look at what I've achieved. Look at what I've done. Look at what Joseph has accomplished. I'm going to show my brothers. I told them they would bow down to me one day." But when he was at second command to Pharaoh, Joseph understood, "I'm not here because of me. I'm here because of God. God put me here just like God allowed me to be in the pit." And so he understood that. And there's some verses, there's some things that Joseph said throughout his story that I want us to look at just real quickly. that let us know that Joseph had that keen sense of God's presence in his life. Look at Genesis chapter 39, verse 9. We're just going to read that one verse, and then we're going to move on to another one. But Genesis chapter 39, verse 9, this is where Potiphar's wife had approached him. And here is what Joseph says. He says, "There's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he," meaning Potiphar, "kept anything from me but you." In other words, you're the only thing that he has said off limits because you're his wife. Now look at what he says here at this last sentence. He says, "How then can I do this great wickedness?" Now if he stopped right there, it would mean, how can I do this great wickedness to Potiphar, who has entrusted everything to me? But he doesn't stop there. Look at what he says. "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against who? God." You see, Joseph understood that he wasn't in the position he was in Potiphar's house because of Potiphar. He understood, I'm here because this is where God wants me. God has placed me here. God is the reason, I'm not going to do anything to mess this up and sin against God. You see, he sees his ultimate accountability to God, not simply Potiphar. Now, he was accountable to Potiphar, but also to God. Look at chapter 40, verse 8. Chapter 40, verse 8. And this is where they're asking him to interpret the dream when he's in prison. And they have... They are about to tell him the dream, and they say in verse 8, they say, "We each have had a dream, and there's no interpreter of it." And listen to what Joseph says. It says, "So Joseph said to them, 'Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please.'" You see, Joseph could have said, "Hey guys, I can tell you what your dream means." He didn't have to give God the credit. But his first response is, his first thought is, "Okay, you guys, these guys are telling me they've had a dream. They're kind of troubled by it. Don't all interpretations to dreams belong to God?" And so even when he's in prison, Joseph understands, you know, just because I'm in prison doesn't mean God's not in control. The earth hasn't gone off of its axis just because I'm in prison. God hasn't walked off and forgotten me and everybody else just because I'm in prison. Joseph's in prison. He's at a low point in his life. There's no reason. He's innocent. There's no reason for him to be in prison. He could have sat in prison and sulked and said, "I'm innocent. I was framed. This isn't right." And he could have had this horrible attitude, but he understands, no, maybe God has me here for a reason. And he understands God is still with him. And so he doesn't sit in prison and pout. He doesn't cause a riot. He doesn't do any of that. He does the best that he can in his circumstances. He's just even keeled, and he's just steady, and he has a peace in his life. Look at chapter 41, verse 16. Genesis 41, verse 16. And this is where Pharaoh has called him to interpret his dream. And Pharaoh's heard that Joseph can interpret the dream. And Pharaoh thinks this Hebrew can interpret the dream. But Joseph clears things up real quickly. Look what he says in verse 16. He says, "Joseph answered Pharaoh saying, 'It is not in me.'" In other words, I'm not the one who can interpret your dream. And here he is. He's standing in front of Pharaoh. I mean, this is like standing in front of, you know, the president or the king of the world or something like that. And that person saying, I think you can tell me something, and you're bold enough to say, "I'll be glad to help you, but let me tell you who's really going to help you right here. God." You see, and understand something. Pharaoh. Who did Pharaoh think he was? Audience participation here. Who did Pharaoh think he was? Pharaoh thought he was God. So Joseph's standing there saying, "Well, you know, God can interpret your dream." And I can only imagine Pharaoh going, "No, I can't. I need a little help here," you know. Because the Pharaohs were seen as kind of like gods. And here this Hebrew boy, he's not very old at this time, a young adult, 20s-ish, stands there and says, "Pharaoh, if you're just looking for me to tell you your dream, I can't do it. But what he's saying is I know somebody who can. My God can interpret your dream. Now, Joseph could have taken the credit for it, couldn't he? But he wasn't about to do that, because he understood the reason he was standing in front of Pharaoh is because God was with him. You see, Joseph never gets too high and he never gets too low. And there are other instances there in that chapter 41 where we see that Joseph is constantly aware of God's presence in his life. And that's what brings stability and peace to us, is an awareness of God's involvement in our lives. You see, even we as Christians, sometimes we live as if things are luck or fate or chance. But the Bible tells us very clearly there is no luck or fate or chance. But that no matter what our situation is, God is with us. God is bigger than our circumstance. We don't, you know, when things are going well, we need to be happy and we need to rejoice and we need to thank God and we need to count our blessings and all those things that we say we need to do. But we don't need to get too high on ourselves. But the other end of that is that when things aren't going so well, we don't need to wallow in that and we don't need to gripe and grumble and complain, because God is with us still. You know, just because you're in difficult circumstances doesn't mean that God has forgotten you. If you believe, you know, just that, well, you know, luck and chance and fate, you'll never live a life of stability and peace. You'll always be on that roller coaster. You'll always be up and down, up and down. And the truth of the matter is we kind of never really get off of that, because you don't control what happens, but you do control how you respond to it and how you deal with it and how you let it affect you. And the point about Joseph is that he never let it affect him in a negative way. He always maintained what we would call a steady faith. A steady faith. And he was stable. He was even. And he never got too high and he never got too low. Evenness and steadiness comes from knowing that God is in control and knowing that God is present and active in this world. And it's important to believe both of those. There are a lot of people who believe that God is present in the world, but they don't think he's doing anything. They don't think he's active. There are a lot of people who believe that God is active, but he's really not present. He's too busy off there somewhere up in this, you know, in outer space, and he's dealing with all these spiritual things and parts of the universe, but he's not really right here. But when you read the Bible, what does the Bible teach you? The Bible teaches you that God is present, he's here, he's knowable, he's with you. But he's not just kind of walking around checking on you. See, a lot of people think God is here, but all he's doing is he's walking around behind you going, okay, yeah, you really messed up right there, Ken. I'm noting that. Oh, boy, you really blew it again. You weren't too nice to that person right there. I'm noting that. Oh, well, you did okay there. I'll give you a gold star there. Oh, well, you know, you blew it there because, you know, you shouldn't have blown your horn at that person that cut you off. And people have this concept that that's what God is doing, that all he's doing is walking around with this checklist, checking off our behavior. And then he's really not doing anything to impact our lives. But Joseph understood, God is here, God is active in my life, God's hand is on my life, whether I'm in the palace or whether I'm in the pit. And what I want to ask you tonight is can you believe that? Can you believe that not just for Joseph, but can you believe that for you? Can you believe that God is with you, God's hand is on your life, whether you're in the pit or in the palace? Even what Joseph named his children reflects his awareness of God's work in his life. Remember, after this, you're going to read chapter 41, we're told about the birth of Joseph's children. And he names the first of his children Manasseh, which means to forget. And so in that, he's saying, you know, I've put the past behind me. Because believe me, Joseph had a past, didn't he? I mean, we all think we've got a past, but Joseph had a past. because he had some brothers that literally wanted to kill him and literally threw him in a pit and left him, we're going to leave him for dead, and literally sold him into slavery. He had a lot of baggage to get over. But it comes to the point where his son is born and he names him Manasseh, which means to forget. And I think that's Joseph's way of saying, you know, I've found freedom from my past. I've been able to let that go. And then he has another son. And he names his second son Ephraim, which means fruitful. And when he had that son, he said that God had even been able to make him fruitful in the land of his suffering. Most of us think of the times of suffering in our life and go, I don't think that was very fruitful. But when you look back on it, the times of your suffering and your difficulty may have been the most fruitful times of your life if you responded in the right way. Because that's when your faith would have grown the most. And so even as Joseph looks back on his life, he says, you know, God has been faithful to me. God has been with me. I've been in the pit when most people would have just abandoned their faith and walked away from God because they thought God didn't care about him, and he was able to maintain his faith. He'd been in the palace. He had been at the height of power when many people would have gotten full of themselves and said, I've made it. Who needs God now? But he held on to his faith and his humility because Joseph understood whether he was up or whether he was down, God was always with him. And he always gave God the credit for everything that happened in his life. Learn the lesson of Joseph. Learn the lesson of Joseph. And that is that God is always at work. God is always present and active in your life. God is always involved in your life. And when you understand that, you won't get too low in the difficult times. You won't get too high in the good times. And God's looking for those kind of people. That's what we call peace. Jesus said, I come to give you peace. My peace I leave with you. And if you're looking for that peace tonight, it's found in Jesus. Because if you don't have Jesus in your life, you are just going to be a slave to the ups and downs, the circumstances of your life. But when you have him, you know that your eternity is secure, that you don't have to rise and fall with your situation or your circumstances, but you can have a steady, even, consistent faith because of who he is. Let's pray together.